Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hi, good evening everybody. My name is Grace Lorden. I'm on faculty here at the LSE. I am the Director of the Inclusion Initiative, who is hosting this event tonight along with DSI, the Data Science Institute. You're very, very welcome. There is three things that I'm going to tell you before I'm going to be quiet and be actively listening just like you. First, we do have an online audience. So my colleague, Debbie Canna, is here in the front to take questions from the online audience when the Q&A comes. I'm going to pass over to the moderator of the event in a second, and there's going to be a chat among the panelists. For people who are online, please put in your questions as the conversation flows. And for people who are in the room, please do get your questions ready and the moderator will come to you in due course. And the last thing that I have to say is to introduce the moderator. It is my pleasure to introduce Belton Flournoy, who is a Managing Director in Protivity's Technology and Digital Consulting Space. Belton Flournoy is on the advisory board of the Inclusion Initiative. He's also the founder of Protivity's, the UK's LGBTQ plus group. He has also won an extraordinary amount of awards for being an inclusive individual in London City. And on top of all that, he is the founder of Pride in the City. And one last thing, if his achievements sound like a lengthy list, he's also an incredibly nice guy. So you're going to have a wonderful moderation here this evening. I'm going to pass over to Belton. My only other job will be to let him know when it's 5 minutes to time, so you all get out here at the right time, and to give a small amount of closing remarks. But please join me in welcoming Belton Flournoy and the rest of the panel this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Can you hear me through the microphone? Perfect. So I am very excited to be here and very excited for this conversation. Please do get thinking about your questions now. We will be going to questions part of the way through the evening. And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves, and then I'm going to also ask them to maybe share what first attracted you to AI. And maybe let's start on this end.
So, hi everyone, thank you for being here. So I'm Noam, the CEO and co-founder of Citrus6. We are an AI risk management platform. We are allowing companies, especially high-risk ones, to deploy and work with AI responsibly and according to AI regulations. So what led me to AI all my life and doing what we are doing in Citrus6, that all my life I'm in the intersection between technology, regulation, and risk. I worked for the Ministry of Finance, I worked for the National Bank, so the need for being innovative but also doing it responsibly and for the society and according to different regulation, this is what attracted me to establish Citrus6.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Matthew Blakemore. I established AI Karumba this year, actually, which is a company that oversees businesses' AI strategy, which I think is an area that a lot of businesses struggle with, definitely, when they're thinking about how they can get the most out of this new technology. I actually started working with AI back in 2014, and it's really interesting to see how the technology has developed since then. I really got involved with AI out of necessity, because I was running a startup back then, fashion technology, and the only way we could do what we wanted to do, which was to improve the in-store experience, was to think about computer vision and how we could utilize that in store. So that's how my journey began with AI.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Scott, and I most recently spent 12 years with Google, which is obviously an AI native. And since last November, I've launched an advisory firm with three other partners. And we've been advising companies. I'd say the common thread is in tech. It's not all been in AI. But I have been deeply interested in AI. I could see, so I was leading B2B marketing for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And I could see the potential of how it transformed our customers' businesses. So very excited about the future potential. Maybe not so much yet, the future potential for it to really help us solve some of our biggest societal problems.
And I'm Richard Nesbitt. I'm a graduate of the LSE from 1986, MSc in Accounting and Finance, and I ran a Canadian bank, and I ran the Stock Exchange in Canada, so I'm here as your corporate delegate, I guess. all the corporate boards that I sit on today are interested in AI, and I'll be talking about that tonight.
Hi, and I'm Reshma Sheikh. I am currently head of AI transformation at Evershed Sutherland, which is it's a large city law firm. And I basically, very similar to Noah, has basically spent my entire career at the nexus of technology and people. And I'm most passionate about digital transformation through technology. So first fell into AI, basically working for a large academic publisher, where we basically ran a large, very, very large technology department, and we started doing things with AI back then. And then eventually, as Gen AI kind of came out, became very, very important for us as a large, the academic publisher is a large content provider, to really have a view as to what we're going to be doing with Gen AI, and work with them for a long time, and now work at a law firm doing very, very similar things.
Well, thank you. What a wonderful set of individuals. I look forward to talking to each of you. And maybe to start things off, Caroline, I'm going to come to you. We hear about AI every day and how it's going to solve our problems. Maybe just to begin the conversation, can you level set on the different types of AI that's out there used by both individuals and organizations?
Yeah. Can you hear me if I lean back? Okay. So I think the first thing that's worth saying is AI has actually been in our lives for 10 years or more. It's what I've heard referred to as analytical AI, and it's a lot of, you know, it powers a lot of things that we use every day. So recommendation engines, preference engines, online advertising, there's a lot of things that are powered by what we call analytical AI. So it's only been in the past couple years since, ChatGPT was launched, that we've had generative AI. So most people, the public, general public, I think, that's been the exposure for most people, has been the large language models and the chatbots. For businesses, there's been a bit more application. And I'd say there's probably mainly three areas. So one is a lot of them are using off-the-shelf tools. They're using publicly available off-the-shelf tools, not customized. Second category is they're using off-the-shelf tools with a bit of customization and a bit of proprietary data added in. And then the third category is really the most advanced ones, which is a lot of businesses not so advanced so far. But it's developing some of these foundational models from scratch that are really customized toward industry, toward data, toward specific use. And those are the ones that I know we'll talk about value in a bit. Those are the ones that are really going to deliver the eventual value as the off-the-shelf models just become table stakes, really. So it's those things. I think for the public, it's really the chatbots. And then for businesses, it's those three types of tools right now.
Okay, thank you. And I think it's really interesting when we think about AI and how it's built. I guess, Noah, you are CEO of a company that deals with AI. Can you tell us, I guess, the different types of data sets these technologies might use, and how does that data set impact the outputs of a model?
So first of all, I have to say that the most important things to take in consideration is garbage in, garbage out. So data is everything. And you have all kind of different data that you can use. As Caroline mentioned, there is the more traditional machine learning that they use structured data, so it can be a categorical, a numeric. There is the new generation, there was already all kind of neural networks that use text and pictures and videos. And now in generative AI, there is even more capabilities. But the most important is, what is the quality of the data? What is the quantity of the data? Do we have enough data to make decisions, to make all the decisions that might occur? And in the end, all the biases, all those issues of risk that we are trying in Citrus6 to help companies to deal with and mitigate is all because of the data. So you have to take in consideration what is the data that they're using, if there are problems in the data or biases, because it's historical data, you need to take actions and fix the data or change the data or use even synthetic data in order to be able to create in the end the model that deals properly with the questions that you want to generate or have an answer for.
Okay, thank you. And I guess when we are trying to get benefits, Richard, you were speaking earlier, you sit on a variety of boards, and they're all, I guess, chasing these benefits as part of their investments. What are some of the benefits you've been seeing these boards really wanting to push out through their organizations?
Yeah, so I really break it down into regulated industries versus unregulated industries. So regulated industries like banking and insurance and healthcare, for example, they are on a very go slow approach. So I'm familiar with lots of the chairs of risk committees, boards of banks. They are not going to allow AI models into their production systems until they're darn ready and they know they're safe, and they don't know that they're safe today. So that's going very slow, although I would say all the banks have multiple projects going on AI. In the unregulated industries, moving much, much faster. Lots of different applications are cropping up in everyday use. And the one I usually give is, I sit on the board of a paper company, makes paper in Canada, in Montreal. And in their new plant, they have eliminated the drivers on forklifts. And now they have 12 forklifts driving around the factory continuously, 24 hours a day. Picking up paper, putting the paper over there, picking up boxes, putting the boxes over there, and they have used it as a product productivity enhancement and a cost reduction. So it really, I think the speed of movement is much faster in the unregulated industries.
Oh, that's interesting. And Caroline, maybe I'm going to come to you, and it's kind of a follow-on question. Do you think We hear AI as kind of the golden bullet for success, and Richard is talking about the difference between regulated and unregulated industries. Do you think organizations are actually even ready to find value, or do you think it's just a fad that everyone's interested in talking about?
I definitely don't think it's a fad, but I still think it's early days with the technology. And I think that there's probably about, in a Deloitte survey, there's about 70% of companies right now that are using some type of generative AI. And about 50% of those are still using off-the-shelf solutions, and I think that the value is really going to come when they start doing more custom solutions. So I think right now there are some companies. There's been a lot of experimentation, a lot of piloting. I think where companies are is they're having challenges with scaling the value, so some are getting value out of it. It's still a very small percentage of the EBIT of the earnings, but it's all been very promising so far. Scaling it is the tricky bit, but with everything, with technology, they're usually a set of high performers, early high performers, a small set. And I think it was a McKinsey study I was reading where there's five things that they found that the high performers are doing well over everyone else, the general amount of companies using Gen AI right now. And there's two things in strategy, two things with the tech, and then one with governance. So the two strategy things are, it's in the business goal, and they're still understanding what the right business goal is, and then figuring out, backing up from that, and figuring out how technology can help them get there. So they're still using a business goal that drives value for the company, and that's the most important thing. Technology is really just the platform to help them deliver that value. The second thing in the strategy is the company, the high performers, are looking across the whole organization, and they're thinking about how do we transform the business, not just executing technology for technology's sake. But it's about, you know, how do we do supply chain differently? How do we rethink this whole thing that we've been doing for so long into something new? And then again, technology is just the enabler. It's not the strategy itself. And then on the tech side, the high performers are using a combination of analytical AI that has existed for a long time, together with Gen AI. So it's not just Gen AI alone in a silo. It's the two of those together, and how do they leverage that? And then also on the technology side, the high performers are leveraging proprietary data, and they're understanding the importance of data to making progress with AI and delivering value to the business. And so they're investing in it, and they're doing things like cleaning up the data, or investing in data security and data cleanup. I'd say the final thing is on the governance. So probably because some of these companies are a little bit further along, they're a little bit more digitally mature, Gen AI mature, they've already encountered some of the downsides of AI. And so they're aware of the risks, and they're putting some of the early best practices in place to mitigate against the risks. So I do think there's value there. I think it's still early days, but there have been really, really promising green shoots of the value.
Oh, fantastic. Now, Matthew, I'm going to come to you and ask you a difficult question now. We've heard from Caroline, we've heard from Richard, and we've heard about organizations, some adopting it more than others. You work in strategy, so you're working kind of in that pointy end of seeing a variety of companies and seeing what they do. Can you share your thoughts on what are some of the big trends you've been seeing come from the conversations you've been having?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, ChatGPT really caught the imagination of a lot of people because it was the first time that the public in general were able to communicate with AI and realize they were communicating with it. And I think, you know, for years we've been receiving recommendations from AI and we wouldn't necessarily associate that with AI. And equally, companies have had AI in their workflows and they wouldn't even necessarily realize it. Like, if you're in music production, so many of the tools within the music production tools already are AI. Autotune, for example. And so I think, you know, there's companies that, when they saw ChatGPT, got very excited about AI and started thinking about it as if they had never done AI before in their lives. And actually, they were surprised when I go in and I say, okay, well, what are your current workflows, to see that AI is already inherently part of their workflows. The other thing that I have seen, and it comes back to your point on strategy and getting it right with the business objectives, is quite often there's a lot of pressure from board level to implement generative AI because it's almost seen as a bit of an arms race. And there's so much talk at the moment about, you know, if a company implements generative AI, they give themselves an edge over the competitors. Well, yes. But also, it's about understanding how you use generative AI to get that edge over competitors. It's not just a case of implementing ChatGPT and then suddenly you are ahead of your competitors, because if you don't know how you're going to use it and it doesn't fit with the business objectives, then it's not going to see big returns. And one of the interesting things I have seen is some companies that are thinking about business objectives have actually looked at technology that was developed maybe late 1990s, early 2000s, deep learning technology, have implemented that in 2024 and have seen bigger gains this year than the ones that have implemented just generative AI. And I think that's a really important point. It's about thinking strategically about all these AI breakthroughs we've had, not just the ones from this year, and how they can add value to your business.
That's a really good point. And you kind of mentioned the arms race that's happening amongst these organizations. I guess, Richard, when it comes to organizations chasing that value, how do they balance that, I guess, with maybe more responsible use of AI?
Well, I think, take the banks, for example. We learned in 2008 that if something can go wrong, it will go wrong, right? That was the 2008 financial crisis. And the regulators lost complete trust in the industry. So now you have the regulators have a tremendous amount of power over the industry. And also boards lost trust in their staff and their not only their production staff, but also in their ability to control the risk of those staff. So they significantly increased the amount of risk management personnel. And so I think that what you're seeing in the banking industry is we don't want to repeat that mistake again. Okay. And so, yes, and what I encounter is this. The internal technology departments, there's probably some people here from those, they claim they can build all this, and they probably can, right? They claim they can build the governance models for these as well, so that management will be comfortable. Too bad, not going to trust you. Okay, if you're the board, no, you need third-party validation. So who does third-party validation? People like NOAA and CitrusX, people like Deloitte and PwC. So these companies are going to have to really up their game on AI And they're going to go through a learning curve much like they did on, say, cybersecurity. So cybersecurity, you know, that's been ongoing for about 10 years. They had, at the beginning of that process, they knew nothing about cybersecurity. And today, you kind of need your auditing firm to give you a clean bill of health on your cybersecurity footprint. Same thing's happening on AI right now. It'll move faster. And also, I think that I really like what Carolyn said. Like, technology is not a strategy. You first of all have to have a strategy, then you decide what kind of technology to use to achieve that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thought process that banks and others are going through right now.
Thank you for that. And I know you were speaking about kind of the regulation aspects of it. What about the ethics of it? And Reshma, I'm going to come to you. You've spoken about trying to make ethics more than just a consideration for AI. What does that really mean and entail?
Yeah, so I like how Richard actually did separate out this idea of regulated versus unregulated industries, right? Because that actually, my experience, is really true. Regulated industries are moving a lot slower than unregulated industries. But that also goes into the thought process of where are you using this technology? What are you planning on doing with it? And you know, in regulated industries, like a law firm, like a bank, you know, you really care very deeply about risk, about what's going to happen with your data. And with unregulated industries, it just feels like, you know, we gotta go. You know, we talked about the sort of arms race. They exist in both spaces. But what really needs to happen is this idea of kind of taking a big step back and actually differentiating and saying, okay, we've got a problem here. Is AI actually the right use for this? What am I planning on doing with this? What is the implication of applying AI to the specific problem? While I think everybody over here has had to follow that same journey in learning about AI in our careers, and we've realized that, you know, there's a difference between ethical AI and responsible AI. Responsible AI is, how do I build this stuff so that, you know, it's transparent, it's fair, there's privacy, all of that other stuff. Ethical AI is, I'm going to sit down and think about this use case. I'm going to think about the problems of this use case by the application of this technology, what problems might come out, and therefore, am I going to go back in or am I going to fix the system before I apply it? So those are some of the things that most companies really need to start thinking about. Mm-hmm. Because it's true, right? This technology, I think someone talked about this. This technology today is kind of evolving at a pace where initially, it's going to really provide some operational and cost gains, because that's the most logical application for it today. And that basically means job losses or retraining of staff. And, you know, how do we ensure that we protect the populace as we kind of look to be able to introduce these technologies?
Well, that's fantastic. And I think I might just kind of quickly come down the panel and ask everyone a yes or no question. From your experience, and we'll start here on this one, do you think organizations are actually doing enough to think about the ethics as they're implementing?
I think that most organizations are now cottoning on to the fact that they need to think about it, either because they truly, truly, it's a part of who they are, or because everybody else is and they want to be a part of the group that is thinking about it, right? So I do think that organizations are thinking about it, but most organizations don't actually know how to introduce that into their system. Mm-hmm. So a really good example, you know, we're thinking about ethical applications of AI, but we're also thinking about the ESG applications of AI, which I think no one's really talking about. But it's like, well, you know, we have a responsible business plan. AI requires compute. Compute requires carbon. How do these things match? Mm-hmm. So, but have we solved that problem? Do we know what to do with it just yet? We're still figuring that out.
And what about the three of you? Are people normally considering ethics, or are they really considering the business value first?
Well, I think there's been some famous mistakes out there in the past few years. So I think we learned a lot from that. So I think originally they were not thinking about this, right? And you would have thought, well, it's pretty obvious that you should have thought about this. But they, you know, that's just human nature, right? Mm-hmm. So they didn't. So I think we've learned from those mistakes. And now it's actually made people much more cautious in terms of what they will actually release, you know, onto their customer base. Mm-hmm. That's my view of it.
Yeah, and I don't want to mix ethics with governance, but I do think they're related, because governance is kind of the, in a way, the solution to the ethical problem, right? And I think that is, from what I've seen and read, that's sort of the biggest challenge. It's like, if we talk about what's next for businesses, adopting Gen AI, they're at a point. A lot of them have piloted, experimented. They're starting to scale. They're starting to figure out how to extract value. But the biggest challenge to adoption, it is on the governance side. And I've read that some of them are actually starting to, because regulation is also evolving. We don't know how it's going to evolve. And so I've read some of them are actually doing maps, decision maps, to map out how it might evolve and you know, therefore what that means. So I do think it's top of mind for many.
I think ethics is a bit of a minefield because, as we've touched on, it's not really the same as responsible AI implementation. I think it's fair to say that ethics is very subjective. It's not black and white. There's a lot of gray. And it comes down to individual companies and individuals themselves as to what they think is ethical and what isn't ethical. Obviously, there are lines. Eversheds would know these lines because it's kind of legal lines, really. But beyond that, there is a lot of gray area and there's a lot of points of view all around. And what I've seen, unfortunately, is a lot of companies come out of nowhere that claim they are the gods of AI and they are the only ethical way forward. And I think that's a problem because actually these ethical conversations should be being had within businesses. What do we stand for? What is our ethical position on this and why? How can we justify the position that we have? How are we going to present this to the public? And I think that is what needs to happen really within a lot of companies.
And that's a very good point. And I guess, Noah, taking into consideration everyone's comments, I think when I first heard about your technology, I found it fascinating. But how does Citrus X, I guess, help organizations on that journey to, I guess, assess their own AIs within their organizations?
So, regarding everyone now spoke about the ethical and responsibility, so we are working mainly with a high-risk organization, so they are more strict what is ethical and what isn't. We are working a lot about Fair Lending Act, for example, so there they are looking to make sure that there are not any biases, that the bank give the loans to different population in a different way. So we are really targeting those use cases when we know what is good and bad, and we are seeing that it's not enough just to check for biases or to check for fairness, but you need that human oversight to make sure that he knows that people in the organization knows to create the specific thresholds and to know what are the parameters as we are using explainable AI to see what's the features behind each and every decision in order for us to understand if the organization made the right decision and the same features are affecting the different populations. So this is where responsible AI and ethical AI needs to come together when we are taking the tools from responsible AI for transparency and explainability and monitoring with the ethical parameters of fairness, biases, and all those things together. And this is what we are trying to give to the management level in the organization that we are working with in order, as Richard mentioned, that they will feel they can be accountable to the models and adopt it properly and gain for their business from the models.
No, quite interesting. And I think that you make a lot of really good points. And I think, Caroline, earlier you mentioned you feel that AI is going to help to solve some of the world's biggest problems. What are some of those big world problems that you think AI is going to help with?
So I don't think we're there yet. I think it's still early days with the technology, and I think one of the principles of technology is people tend to overestimate the short-term impact of it and underestimate the long-term impact. And I think the longer-term impact, and that really when some of these bigger problems are going to be solved, is with AGI, which is artificial general intelligence. And a lot of the creators of AI, like Demis Hassabis, Google DeepMind, his prediction is going to come within the next 10 years. And when that happens, the transformation is going to be very much felt. It's predicted to be more transformative than the internet was, than mobile phones, because the technology is going to be so much more powerful. I'm not a neuroscientist, but the way he was explaining it in neuroscientist terms is that, you know, humans have a prefrontal cortex and there's a limit to what we can do with processing. these machines and this technology are already showing early signs of processing and understanding context and inference that even the creators of them did not predict even 5 years ago. They've been surprised by it. And so with artificial general intelligence, it's really predicted to be able to, some say, you know, more intelligent than humans, and to be able to process things, especially abstractions that humans can't really process in a different way. And so that's when I think we're really going to see a bigger impact. It's not quite yet, but I think that, you know, some of those areas are healthcare. My hope is that some of our biggest societal problems, but there have been people who've said that they predict it could solve our energy crisis, it could help cure diseases. So I do think it's going to be transformative, but it's not now. It's early days now, but there have been green shoots that point us in that direction.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's going to be an exciting time period to live through when it's starting to help solve some of our big problems. I guess, what about the elephant in the room? Reshma, I'm going to come back to you for this one. I know, for example, Microsoft and Google's greenhouse emissions have been rising significantly in recent years, in part to Copilot and Gemini and a variety of the other tools. What is an organization's responsibility to the environment when there's this arms race to try to get that next big product done?
So here we kind of enter into the sort of like, comes back to the total cost of ownership of using these technologies or creating these technologies, right? And also this idea of who's responsible for the innovation and who's responsible for regulation. We're all worried, well, most of us are worried about climate change. I don't want to use like big bombastic, like everyone is worried about this. Lots of people are worried about climate change. And one of the things that's becoming very clear is, very anecdotally, you know, the first day I joined the firm, there was a lady that we were going through our induction together. We were joking around about how, you know, every time you send a thank you email to someone, sent you something, send a thank you email, that email actually is probably more wasteful than actually printing out the email to begin with, because of the amount of compute power required to be able for it to kind of go to the other person. So, you know, we're all sending out these like really wasteful messages, and that sort of becomes 8-fold, 25-fold when you're looking at the use of AI. So one of the things that we're currently considering and is effectively just saying, okay, can we go to, because we're much more in the buy and implement rather than build our own right now. It's just trying to understand from vendors, do you understand the AI, the greenhouse impacts of your technology? If not, let's start insisting that you do. Can you just tell me from a supply chain perspective, how much carbon are you using and how are you planning on offsetting that? Because as a part of our responsible business plan, we are thinking about this. Again, none of this is in play right now. These are all considerations. But I do believe that, like, moving forward, we do need to start thinking about these and asking our vendors to be able to provide their almost their certificate of like how much are you spending from a greenhouse perspective, so that each company that's committed to corporate social responsibility and trying to be net carbon neutral by a certain time can take that into account as they build their responsible business plans.
That's fascinating, and I think you all heard it here first. Cut back on those thank you emails.
Genuinely.
I guess, Matt, one of the things that I found really interesting about you and your background was the work you did with ISO. Mm. Can you maybe tell everyone a little bit about the organization and kind of what your work was with them?
Sure. So largely because of Cambridge Analytica, actually, and what they did in the UK and my anger about how they treated personal data and utilized it to try and, yes, whether they did or not, I'm not going to get into that debate today, but, you know, swing a very close referendum. And so because of that, I thought, well, you know, hang on, are there organizations out there that are actually doing something to try and ensure that this technology is developed safely and responsibly? And that's really where I got involved with the British Standards Institute, which in turn is linked to the International Standards Organization. And we work on various standards. There's so many different strands, you couldn't possibly be across all the different standards that they work on. But there's an AI committee, and we feed into lots of different standards. So, for example, the AI system standard, which is 42001, which companies will soon be able to certify against. And, you know, that standard has mentions energy consumption and the importance of actually in order to achieve conformity, thinking about how you can reduce the energy consumption. What I would say is it's been, I've been very happy to read this week that AWS and Microsoft, I believe, as well, are aiming by 2025 to be 100% renewable across all of their cloud computing, which is huge because, you know, a lot of the negativity I read about generative AI is the energy consumption. But if we can be certain that because these companies have invested in putting their servers in territories where they can utilize solar and they can utilize geothermal energy, and we can be sure that it's not going to be damaging the environment, I think that's a huge positive.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I think that is a huge positive in the right direction of travel as well. Noah, you just to build off of that a little bit, kind of you mentioned earlier you work with kind of regulated entities. Can you maybe talk about some of the regulations and how regulations are driving what people are doing compared to the standards that are being set by organizations like ISO?
Yes. So just like And now, I don't know how much about you are you familiar with the regulation, but there was supposed to be a new regulation in California that responsible there decided to put a veto and not to make this new regulation of AI because of all the Meta and Google and all those strength regarding him. So there is a lot of happening in the regulation atmosphere regarding AI. The European Union were the first one to put something very strict. After some of the more Eastern countries that started to do all kind of regulation, in the European Union, they decided to do not horizontal regulation, but more decided to split it to type of risks. So as we mentioned as part of the conversation about the high risk, medium risk, low risk, and this regulation is different for each type of risk. In other countries, such as the UK, in Canada, in some of the, in Colorado, there is already a regulation. Some of them is more horizontal, and some of them is specific to specific industries. In my opinion, the thinking about taking different industries and deciding what's supposed to be the different regulation in those industries is one of the more relevant and the more responsible for us because different industries need different regulation. And we are allowing our customers to work with the different regulation, if it's in HR or if it's in, as I mentioned, fair lending, mortgages, insurance, and so on, and be able to customize for a specific regulation in a specific country, what should be your measurements of taking actions regarding all the measurements that you need to take. But the I see in my perspective that the regulators are doing a lot of the pushbacks about the AI, and because the companies are worried about the regulators, they are taking more into consideration about testing more and putting it more in POCs and pilots before taking it to production, because they are frightening, as Rachel mentioned, since the 2008, they are really worried about regulation, their job, and so on. So the regulation is putting a lot of the work of those risk management compliance officers, even the CIOs of the companies, to put more safeguards and more responsible and ethical measurements in order to be able to, in the end, to deploy a better product.
And, you know, in recent years, we've seen kind of the privacy regulations coming out everywhere, and they're starting to differ and just becoming a minefield for organizations to try to support compliance. Do you think the regulators globally need to start working together more when they're crafting these regulations to create a consistent framework, or do you think they should be?
So I think that we all like, the goal for us is to have one regulation, if it's the OECD or the United Nations, that will everyone will be aligned with. But because we have different countries with different agendas and different powerful groups inside of the countries, for example, what we saw just in California, it didn't happen in Colorado, for example. So Meta has more power in one state in the US than in another state. So to think about it globally, I can just dream about it.
Oh, really good point. I guess, Rashma, coming back to you, I guess, if it can't be standardized kind of from a regulatory perspective, maybe what are some things that organizations can do as like good prerequisite best practice when they're starting on this journey to create that synergy?
Yeah, so I think this is where it's really interesting because global firms do have to worry about regulation in all of the different firms that they, all of the different jurisdictions that they work in, and being able to come across, being able to work and operate in those jurisdictions does require companies like yours. So it's really great to see that it exists. So companies in general, I think again, it comes back down to the ethical standards and what are you planning on doing with your data? How are you planning on processing it? What are the use cases you're planning on implementing within your firm? What are the outcomes? Do you understand what that might lead to? Do you understand what the negative impacts of those might be? For example, I think that one of the issues that we, going back to one of the earlier uses of AI and the algorithms we all have in our social media, creating, I don't think anybody out there really sat down and thought about, data bubbles or my algorithm is completely different than your algorithm, and we both completely believe the stuff that we see, and that just gets exacerbated as we move forward. So what can companies really do? I think it's, sitting down, thinking about the negative impacts of what they're planning on doing, and recognizing that as regulation is evolving, trying to be able to, I call it like building a map, like creating like a spider chart of all of the different touch points that you have within your organization, so that when the regulation does come, because it will come, you're able to like very quickly adhere to them. And I also think that AI regulation isn't going to be that far off from data regulation. I think they're going to be very similar, at least hand in hand for a while, before it may sort of leapfrog. So I think there's value there to also, we do have some examples of what coming down the pipe.
Oh, interesting, and just a follow-up question, slightly side topic, but do you think data bubbles are causing greater political polarization at all?
I think that is, my personal opinion is that yes, I do think that is the case. It is it's really interesting where two people can, I don't think that the human population can, you get into an accident, you have witnesses looking at the same exact accident, and they all look at it from a slightly different angle because they are standing from different vantage points. That exacerbated into what you truly see or believe or hear, and that is reinforced by the people you spend time with. I truly believe that does create pockets in the world of people seeing things differently, who truly believe that, that what they see is true, and that coupled with humans need to be, that doesn't sound right in English, but anyway, to be in tribes leads to this greater polarization, right? My tribe versus your tribe. I believe in, I don't believe that this happened versus I truly believe that happened. And that then taken onto the anonymization online, oh my goodness. It explains a lot, I think.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for that. And I guess, Matt, coming to you, and you were talking about some of the failures, and I think I kind of got excited there. I'd love to hear about, what are some of the big failures of people's attempted use of AI, and how has that failed?
Sure. I mean, one example I always love to give is Zillow in the US, mm-hmm. Who are a company that whole business model is on buying houses at low cost and selling them at high cost. And they got rid of a lot of their staff having built an AI model that could predict which houses they should buy and at what cost they should buy them in order to turn a profit. And it worked very, very well for several months. And then the market changed. And for whatever reason, because they were not following AI standards or they hadn't really got good advisors, I'm not really sure. They didn't take into account that AI needs to be constantly retrained, that you need to look at how it can adapt to market changes, and they didn't do anything. So they just left the model running, thinking it was in perpetuity going to be perfect. And within 1 month, they lost $500 million. And they had to close down their entire department dedicated to that particular part of the business. And they lost a lot of money off of their shareholders' price as well. So, it just goes to show that, standards are very, very useful as a mechanism to, if you're a business coming to AI for the first time, as a guide to stop that happening to you. but also there's so much information out there now about responsible AI implementation. I mean, Google have produced loads of free courses. There's free courses from Amazon and other providers as well. So I think it's just, bear in mind, this technology is powerful. This technology is useful. But to get the most out of it, there is an education piece, there is an upskilling piece. I think that the World Economic Forum estimated recently that I think it's over 56% of employees are going to need upskilling. So, you know, you may be one of those employees, and it's not shameful to need upskilling. Like, there are resources out there. People understand this technology is new and it's exciting, but at the same time, the more you understand, the more you put yourself in a position to actually drive your business forward and to be a bigger asset for your business.
Hold on. But, you know, that's a really interesting point. And again, this is also in part by LSE's inclusion initiative, which is focused on inclusion. So, Richard, I'm going to come to you next. I know you're the chair of the inclusion initiative. And I think one of the things I'd be really keen to understand from you is we've been speaking about organizations. How can they get benefits? How can they get the benefits of this? But what about the individuals? So for the individuals in the room and in the audience, how can they start getting value from AI?
Well, I would say every student that ends up in industry or government or, you know, almost any organization is going to be confronted with the use of AI as a tool, right? So the more they can learn about that now, and by the way, I would say your professors don't know very much about AI, so you're going to have to probably learn about it yourself. And quite often students know more than the professors, and I teach, and so I know that for a fact. But you're going to be put, whether you go into investment, like trading derivatives, or making corporate loans, or being a risk management officer, you're going to be using AI as a tool pretty much the first day you go in, right? So I think it is moving quite fast, and you have, I think, a duty to incorporate that into your thinking and learning how these products will work. And you need to do it on your own, I think, because the world is not moving fast enough for the institutions to give you that information. And I think students are quite good at doing that, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. So the one thing I think is when we get an explosion in computing power from something like quantum computing, that's when this will really take off. Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems to me that we have fast computers now, but they're not fast enough, right? And but those days will come, and then there will be a real explosion in the applications that we can put AI to.
Okay. No, really interesting. And I guess when AI is starting to automate a variety of these jobs, and Caroline, I'm to come to you, and we hear about it potentially displacing a large number of people, what are some of the skills that we need to be tacking on now and learning to help us navigate this new AI world once it does pop?
Yeah, I completely agree with Richard's point about just needing to know how to use AI from day one. And I think that just to on the point about the impact, we don't know yet about the impact to the workforce. I think a lot of companies are figuring that out, but there will be one in that, and I think we probably all have examples of productivity gained. And you know, I think that I heard Sal Khan, who founded the Khan Academy, speak, and he said that already teachers are saving 10 hours a week. His engineers are 10xing the work they're able to do with AI. And also, we know from a BCG study that was done, I think, late last year, that they gave a group of consultants working on a project a publicly available chatbot to help with their projects. And then a control group had no chatbot. And the ones that had the publicly available chatbot that everybody has access to did the work 25% faster and with 40% better quality. So just knowing how to use it is, you're already going to be at a massive advantage. And I think that, so Ethan Mollick, who's a professor at Wharton Business School in the US, somehow earned the reputation as the world's best prompter. And what he said, he has a lot of great tips, and if you want to follow him, he's got a lot of great information as a newsletter. And he recommends just experimenting, and 10 hours seems to be the sweet spot, because obviously AI is not good at everything. It's, as we said, it's early days. There's limits to it. But 10 hours seems to be the spot where just start doing anything. Just ask it anything. Just start doing things in there. And you can find out its limitations, what it's good at, and also its limitations. And by the way, different chatbots are good at different things as well. I use several of them. So that's one thing, is just start using it, and you're going to need it for basically anything you do. And I do think companies will need to have upskilling plans, and we'll need to care about that more. And the good thing is I think we're seeing them care about that more than 3 or 4 months ago, which is really positive, very positive. But still, a lot of them don't have a plan, especially smaller companies, startups. Anyone who wants to join a start, you know, they may not have the resource, or just that may not be a massive priority right now. So I think that there's a lot of value in upskilling yourself. And then the final thing I would say is, I think critical thinking skills are going to become absolutely one of the most important things in the age of AI, because I've heard that, you know, and I've experienced it myself, that the kind of the magic combination of getting value out of AI is using critical thinking skills with it. So you have to be able to challenge it. It's not accurate. You have to be able to say, you know, I'll actually, if I ask it for stats, I will say, what source did you get that from? And then I'll just ask it, was that accurate? And sometimes it'll come back to me and say, no, I'm sorry, you're absolutely right, it was not. I just checked the information again, and here's the accurate information. So it requires those kind of skills, and also developing ethics for AI, that's going to require critical thinking skills. All of this requires critical thinking. And interestingly, there's a two sides of the coin situation going on here, because to get the most value out of AI, critical thinking really helps. On the other side, AI can actually help develop critical thinking skills. And one of the things that Sal was most excited about, how it's going to change education, is that he says, you know, with the chatbots, the value in them he sees is not providing answers to students, providing facts and history and information. It's in teaching them how to be more better critical thinkers. And so the chatbot that come back and say, give you part of an answer and say, and what do you think happens next? You know, what do you think happens next? So critical thinking is going to be important, but also AI can help develop the critical thinking skills. So that's what I would suggest. Just use it, learn it, use it for everything. Find out its limits. Those limits will change. So it's good to keep experimenting, and then focus on the critical thinking skills. Really, really important.
Okay. Fantastic. And you know, one easy way to use ChatGPT is on your phone. You can turn it and you can press the headphones and you start talking to it. So it makes a lot more easy to kind of leverage that technology. But I do know we are coming to the Q&A section at the moment. And so before we move into that, I want to ask the audience a question. I want you to raise your hand if you are a AI expert in the room. Nobody?
Oh, there's one up there.
At the back.
Oh, there we go. We have one. So we're going to have a question from you, just so you know. Now, we have another one right here. So now I want you to raise your hand if you use AI at least once a week, some form of it. Oh, look at this. You know, if you asked this question 2 years ago, it wouldn't be like this. But now that you all have practiced raising your hands, who wants to ask the first question? And we have a microphone right over here. All right.
There's a lady up there.
Yes. Why don't we go to this lady first, and then we can come to this gentleman and then this gentleman. So the lady right over there. Yes.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question. Like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Should I start? I'm not sure. But I just had a question, particularly on the ethics side of things as well, so probably to Reshma. But it's more like for companies or countries, rather, where they're still experimenting, establishing a digital kind of regulatory side or digital thing, and they're still establishing those frameworks. How does it work to put AI in it now? Is it possible? Will it be successful? And is half the world being left behind as the other half races towards it?
So it's really interesting you talk about this, and I have a couple of follow-up questions to understand your question, but I'm going to make a couple of assumptions here. There are countries that don't have any ability to basically to get on, you know, they have access to the internet, but they don't have the latest or greatest, and they basically may be left behind. Then there are countries that basically leapfrog, right? Like, for example, people talk about M-Pesa, people talk about Paytm, the little QR codes are all, you know, mobile phones revolutionized, democratized the global south, and basically allowed them to come up with innovations that now the global north is looking at and going like, oh my God, that's genius. So let's take ethics out and just talk about like the infiltration of this technology. I do think that this technology, if even taken to the global south, can lead to innovations that the global north hasn't even thought about, because it'll basically, we'll use it in ways to be able to leapfrog the sort of status quo here today. I know people who are looking at using AI in agriculture in Africa today to be able to do better trading of grain, or to be able to understand, you know, climate change and how that may affect, right? Just simple algorithms that are really going to help day to day. Now, it comes to ethics and regulation. I think that's a whole other topic, and I think that I do think those two things are quite separate. So I do think that when you think about ethics and regulation, I'm going to pass it on to Noah, actually, because she'll know a little bit more here. But I would agree that there are countries that are not regulating because they don't want to be hampered by thinking about the ethics side of it. So, but I will throw that to Noah.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, there are different type of regulation and different, more conservative and more strict regulation regarding fairness and all the ethical issues. But I think that overall, all the Western countries or all the countries that want to be part of the OECD or other all kind of organization are putting some ethical regulation in place. And this is why it's so important for us to create the way that every organization, every use case, everything can be very customized to a specific way of what is the level of ethical that we want to take here. But I think, in my perspective, that in several years, all the countries will be aligned for our pretty strict ethical issues, because also organizations are understanding that ethical problems are really connecting to revenues in the end, because mm-hmm. you want to have more customers and a much wider population that you can give your service to or your product to. So in the end, I think it's also that in the perspective of the management level, they want to take those things into consideration.
Yeah,
can I just say, I'm a little less confident that countries will agree on regulation. Reason being, if I'm territory A and I don't have any regulation, and territory B, C, and D decide to bring in regulation, that gives me a massive advantage to attract in technology companies that want no regulation and want to be able to innovate. And the interesting thing with being in the standards bodies is you kind of see this. Even when we're working on standards, the different philosophies of different territories and the different ideas they have around what should be in a standard, what shouldn't be, and kind of the way they see this technology. And so there's this constant, and I've been having conversations with MEPs in the EU, there's this constant balance between bringing in some sort of regulation that protects people as the way they see it, but also that doesn't hinder innovation, or at least hinders it as little as possible. Because one of the things they've been very conscious of, and one of the reasons why the EU AI Act was watered down quite a lot before the final version, was that if they bring in too hard regulations, they will hinder innovation within the EU and push it to the US and other territories in China. And because this technology is so powerful, there really is a very careful balancing act to be achieved in protecting citizens whilst also giving your market the opportunity to really benefit economically from this technology. And so I'm not as confident as you. I wish I was. I wish I was confident to say that all the territories would agree, but I just can't see it personally.
No, but I think we're talking about the length of time, right? We're not talking about 5 years. We're talking about maybe 10.
Yeah.
And we're also talking about this need to be able to trade with a certain country. Mm-hmm. So when you get to a certain point, climate standards are a really great example, right? Like, there are certain countries that refuse to sign up to climate standards because it is economically disadvantageous for them, because they effectively still require old, dirtier technologies to be able to leapfrog or to be able to just kind of continue their economic growth. And the same thing is true of these newer digital technologies. But in the in 10 years' time, will they agree? Will they have, you know, will the damage have been done? Maybe.
We might be at AGI possibly? By 10 years.
That's true.
If we're at AGI in 10 years, all of the regulation we bring in now may be completely irrelevant.
Maybe, yeah.
And it's really interesting with technology, because I know Cambridge Analytica operated in foreign countries before they then brought some of that thinking to the US and the UK. So when we talk about regulating and unregulated countries, they can still move there, and then once they have that idea, just move back in a very interesting way. So I know we had a question in the front row, I believe second.
Hi, mine was more of a comment, but obviously I'm very keen to hear your view on this. I think one of the issues with the emergence of chatbots is that suddenly what was considered machine learning algorithms, they all became under one umbrella term, which is called AI now. And this includes supervised learning, unsupervised learning, reinforcement learning, and deep learning. And the issue with this is it's sort of like the umbrella term of cancer. You know, you can't treat all the cancers the same way. Some respond to immunotherapy, some respond to chemo, some to radiotherapy. And again, it depends when you think about regulation and all these things, it also depends what your aim is. Is it drug discovery? If it's drug discovery, it doesn't matter to be regulated much because it's experimental, and once you get the results, you can assess whether it's feasible or not. But I don't know if you've read Cathy O'Neill's book, Weapons of Math Destruction, the Harvard mathematician who was working at a hedge fund. And essentially, it was about this issues that you know, people were getting categorized in you know, whether they can get certain part of educational schooling because of their zip codes. And this becomes more of a categorization problem. And as such, it's more problematic if there's less regulation there. I think it's, you all touched it to a certain point. You talked about AI, you talked about chatbot, generative AI. But you know, when you talk about supply and chain management, that's more reinforcement learning. You know, some of them are explainable AI. Of course, that's great, something that you pointed at. But I have a feeling it wasn't touched very specifically because certain algorithms want more due diligence than the rest of them. And it depends what the application is. If you're managing someone's portfolio, it's very important that they want to understand what is the, you know, what is explaining this choice of the weights for each asset, essentially. That's just something that I felt it wasn't touched. If you could maybe elaborate on that, please.
Yep, I think you're absolutely right to identify the fact that, you know, we've had AI innovation since the 1950s onwards, and it's got so many different definitions because, you know, I would say that the definition of AI is constantly evolving. You know, back if we look at what we had in the 1950s with rule-based systems, you know, we wouldn't necessarily, if someone created one today, say, that's artificial intelligence. We just wouldn't. But back then, that was AI. And so I think, you know, you're absolutely right. We need to look at the different implementations of AI, so whether it's deep learning, machine learning, and think about the overarching regulation slash thinking around data that applies to it. One of the things we try and do within the standards bodies is actually take into account the different types of AI within the standards so that they can be quite rounded and applied into different types of AI systems. So, for example, the standard I spent most of my time on the last 4 years was the AI data lifecycle standard, which was how can you use data in an AI system effectively? What rules do you need to think about? How can you do this effectively? And that would apply to the generative models we see today, to basic machine learning models as well. And so you're absolutely right. I think there are some things that apply to all models, but fundamentally, a lot of the conversation, as you've correctly pointed out at the moment, is around generative AI, just because it's the buzz, it's what everyone's talking about. But there are so many other forms of AI that are important as well.
But I think it's also the AI that, correct me if I'm wrong, that because it's so much newer, and also it feels like it kind of sits within a black box, we don't actually know how to regulate it. Whereas with machine learning algorithms that one has created themselves, you typically know what data goes in, and therefore how it's kind of built and how it's classifying systems. Sorry, how it's creating that output, and therefore it's easier to govern.
So, yeah, I mean, with deep learning, we have neural networks as well,
sure,
and
yep.
And it always surprises people when I say that actually it was in the period of the 1950s to the 1970s that the first neural network idea actually came about. That was when they were invented, but what unlocked them was cloud computing and, you know, Google, Amazon providing for the first time the powerful enough computing for companies to be able to utilize these models. But absolutely, you're right to point out, you know, Some models provide a lot more transparency than others, and I think that it is the black box nature of neural networks that requires potentially more oversight.
Fantastic. And I know we have some questions that have been posted online, and we also had one more question on this side. So I'm going to come to this question, and then we're going to go to the online questions.
Thanks so much. And really appreciate all the insight from everyone. It's been really, really insightful. My prompt is sort of in a similar vein, and it's around misconceptions of AI in the both literal and figurative boardroom, so to speak. I'm here with a couple colleagues and fellow students from King's. I hope that doesn't get me kicked out of the room. But we're sort of in the beginning of our semester learning about definitions of AI and historical definitions of AI, and very quickly my eyes have been opened to how people are sort of led astray into what that really means. And maybe just prompting for some anecdotes about if people in those rooms really know what they're asking for. You've made these notes about strategy versus technology. And if those intentions in asking for and wanting to push for AI are clear, or if they're really maybe asking for automation or efficiency or different types of technologies. And so maybe what some of those common misconceptions that are permeating those rooms are.
I want to get started with this one, please, desperately. So the main reason I really wanted to talk about it was because genuinely, so I've been in technology for about 20 years and mainly, you know, not in love with technology, but love what it can do, right? And what last year, I think, was the first time I found people who were like, great, Gen AI, we need to do something with this. What can we do? And I, you know, anecdotally, almost like a joke, I said, you know, I think all the CEOs are on some kind of WhatsApp group where they're all chatting with each other and basically saying, you know, I'm going to use AI. I'm going to use Gen AI. And no one knows why or how. So I think, sorry, I really, truly believe this. Because I think what was happening is you can see this technology that your kid's playing with. They're probably cheating on their math homework, like their essays that they need to write to school. It looks really powerful, and you know it's going to do something for your company, but you just don't know what yet. Along with that, I think there's also a little bit of a education issue, right? The person on the board, they're usually like CFOs, salespeople, marketeers. There are very few companies, apart from like the big Silicon Valley companies, right, that are run by technologists. So out comes this new piece of technology that is new, and it's very different, and it's hard to explain on a napkin to somebody. I've tried to do this with my mother. It can be done, but it takes a while, right? So it's difficult. Initially, it was quite difficult for them to really understand what were they looking for, but they wanted to be able to get that competitive edge. So, you know, I can excuse a person in a boardroom who's like, hey, my job is to make sure, like, you know, if I'm a stock listed company, you know, I have fiduciary responsibility for my shareholders to be able to maximize, you know, profits here. And I want to make sure that I can do the best for my company. And I don't know what that just looks like yet, but I'm going to create that mandate. So I can understand that. But I do think that what is happening is people are educating themselves over a period of time. But yes, there was a period where everyone was like, hey, we're going to do something with this. It's going to be great. What are we doing? We don't know yet.
So Richard, are you in that WhatsApp group? No, I'm just kidding. But as someone in the boardrooms, I'd be really curious to get your opinion on how do you think people
understand? So the real problem we have with our boards is management has decided that this is something they want to pursue. So they want money, because it all comes down to money. And so I tend to ask the question, and what are you going to do with this money, right? Besides buy some fancy new boxes and, you know, hire some more people. What exactly are you going to do with it? I would say almost none of them have a clue what they're going to do with it. It's all like throwing a fishing line into the pond, right, and see what happens. I have seen also where people are single-mindedly focused on developing a better solution to a problem using AI, right? I've seen that as well. But most of it is just we're going to give it a try and see what it is. And so that's a very wasteful kind of approach to technology development. Okay. Develop the strategy first, then figure out what technology you want.
Oh, that makes sense. And I know we do need to get to some of the people online, so let's take two questions from the online audience.
Absolutely. So we have a few questions on upskilling and reskilling. One from Freya Owen asks, you mentioned critical thinking as a key skill for success in the future workplace. Amid the changing landscape and uncertainty over the future of jobs, what other skills do you think are important for individuals to learn? And what can L&D strategies focus on?
I'm sorry, could you say the last part of the...
What should L&D strategies focus on?
Learning and development strategies.
Yeah. For companies, this is company L&D strategies. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they've asked, what other skills do you think are important for individuals to learn? And I guess learning, we have a few questions that asked L&D strategies for companies and one from education.
I mean, I think my first, and welcome everybody else to chime in, but I think my first advice would be, goes back to something Richard said, is really just learn the basics of how to use the chatbot, because that's kind of, you know, a lot of companies right now, 50% of them are still using publicly available chatbots. And we saw with the BCG study that even just using a publicly available chatbot can get you pretty amazing evolution of progress, right? So 25% faster, 40% better quality. So I think that would be my first advice. I think though that companies need to, it goes back to them deciding their own vision and mission. And then the L&D is a result of, you know, this is what we're gonna do with AI, this is what we're not gonna do with AI, the ethics, the principles, the vision, and then the execution of that. You know, what's the operating model? And then therefore, what is the L&D plan that needs to come out of that? Because I think other than learning the publicly available tools, beyond that, I would say, I think the company really needs to decide what its vision is, where it wants its employees to go, what different departments need to focus on which different skills. That would be my advice, but invite anyone.
Sure. I mean, I would say that one of the things I'm doing actually is on the side is AI program director of an e-learning platform. And one of the things that I would say actually, if we're talking about beyond the upskilling programs that are available through Google, AWS, and these other platforms for free, and also Harvard for free as well, and possibly LSE. LSE? Yes, there's a nodding face. LSE. Is actually the ability to be flexible and adapt and to constantly be searching. And what I mean by that is, you know, AI technology is developing at such a pace. Yeah. If you stand still for 5 minutes, you will find that you are already behind other people. And so it's a case of being constantly inquisitive, looking for new innovation, thinking about how can I get ahead? What new technology is there? Is there technology that does this for me? You know, when you have a challenge, look up first of all. The first thing you should do when you're given a piece of work to do is think, I wonder if there's any tools that could help me with this particular task. Because the more tools you know in your arsenal, the better employee you are, and the better leader you are as well. So I'd say that's the key thing people are going to need to get in their heads, that they should be constantly looking, constantly searching, and not ever stopping learning about the tools that are available for them.
And just to kind of talk a little bit about L&D strategies, I think it really, just to kind of like, nod to what Caroline was saying, I think it really does depend on what an organization really wants to be able to accomplish. But I think also then looking at the population that you have and also identifying a couple of different things with AI technologies, right? So how important and business critical is it for what you're planning on doing? And also also trying to figure out where does that investment really need to lie? So for example, if these tools are still emergent, they're not giving you that sort of return on investment today, and you have a population that will eventually age out, you know, maybe the idea is to make them understand what the technology is or is not, how can they be able to use it best, but maybe heavily focusing on that incoming that incoming cohort of new talent and trying to be able to ensure that they are upskilled to a way that can use it, utilize that technology and have some of those critical thinking skills and have the ability to keep searching, right? So it's basically looking at your population, understanding that company vision, trying to figure out where, how many efficiency gains are really being provided or what is a differentiator for you and then being able to apply it according to that.
I guess a follow-up question I had is, I know prompt generators were getting paid over $100,000 in New York, and they didn't build the tools, they were just using the tools. When we talk about the skills and people asking what they should be focused
on, engineering,
is it more appropriate for people to be focused on, let me learn how to build these AI tools and get the technical configuration element, or is it actually more useful for people to not even look under the hood and become more efficient at leveraging and developing use cases to apply those tools?
It depends on what you want to do with your life.
Yeah, it depends where your skill set lies, to be honest. Yeah. I would be worried about just dedicating your entire career to prompt engineering, because what we're seeing with natural language understanding is these tools are getting better and better at not requiring as detailed prompts. So I think, don't potentially put your eggs in all in that basket. But it really depends on what you want to do. You know, are you a strategist? Where is your key interest? You know, are you a developer? And then looking at your own skills and AI from that perspective, and where can you apply your own skills, as you're saying, best within that sector? I don't think it's black and white and just a straight answer.
And just to build on that, McKinsey did a study where they were looking at categorization of Gen AI talent within workforces, and actually discovered that only 12% of it was technical. Engineering, research scientists, any kind of technical, and 88% of people who consider themselves good at AI were non-technical roles. You know, it's the communications manager who needs to put out a press release and needs to know how to summarize loads and loads of notes that came from meetings, plus different messages from different executives, and sort of know how to use all that information and get some kind of meaningful PR messages from it. And they said, actually, that's 88% of the workforce. And to the point about, you know, I completely agree, AI is going to become, and that's how the creators are building it, to become more intuitive. And some of Ethan Mollick's advice, going back to the world's best prompt engineer, is that I found this myself using it, to get the best value out of it, you need to talk to it like it's a human. You don't need technical skills. And actually, people who get the most value out of it are people who know how to work best with other humans. If you know how to give good guidance to a team, if you know how to do a good brief, if you know how to give good context, that's where you're going to get a lot of great results out of the tool. And that actually, sometimes the engineers are more technical types struggle because they're used to more of a linear, use another word, but a sort of linear way of thinking, that actually the model is really good about picking up on inference and context. If you just talk to it like it's a human, I've heard someone say, talk to it like it's a drunk university grad. It's smart, but it gets things wrong. Or I've also, you know, heard people say, talk to it like it's a smart intern. I don't think just to bring it back, I don't think technical skills are necessary to get the value out of AI.
And that is a great clarification, because I think for the people who don't know what roles are out there, sometimes you don't even know the breadth of experience that we can get. So I think we have time for a few more audience questions. The 1 second on the end over here. And then our AI expert on this side, I'll be really keen to hear what he has.
Given the developments of ChatGPT, Gemini, and Llama chatbots, which company or companies are best placed to benefit from the future of AI?
I'd like to answer that one.
I can say that I think that all companies can benefit from AI. It's difficult to say who can benefit the most. We can see things in healthcare, and healthcare might be more important than banking or from insurance or other things. So I think it's a too general question to ask, but we all can benefit from it, and especially all the companies that you mentioned can benefit from the money that we will bring them through all those chatbots. So there are for sure benefits from AI.
I would say the companies that are going to benefit the most from those technologies are the ones that actually think about the strategy and why they're doing it in the first place. That's the key thing. Follow product management rules, because a lot of companies have thrown them out the window when it comes to generative AI. And if they go back to basics and say, okay, what are our business objectives this year? What are we trying to achieve? And then think about generative AI, they're going to do a lot better. And so I would say that's the key thing. I mean, the other thing is, even the models you've mentioned there, they all have different benefits. You know, Llama, it's open source, more flexibility. You've got ChatGPT, which has now got this agentic technology, so it can think better, but it costs a lot more. And then you've got Google, which has got the largest token window, so you can achieve, you know, you can put in a lot more data to summarize. So they've all got different benefits, and it's about understanding that and thinking about, okay, well, what's best for my business then?
Fantastic.
Hi, thank you. It's been fascinating. I love AI, but I think we need to be realistic about the downsides. So if I could ask about the other elephant in the room, which is job loss. Now, we've already heard that AI has not been great for Quebecois forklift drivers, and I think a lot of other people are going to be following in that. I use AI all the time, but I don't regard it as a tool. I regard it as a collaborator. And a collaborator can also be a competitor and then a replacement. So if the panel could please maybe just try and come to grips with this rather unpleasant side, what do you think about the future of AI in the workplace, specifically with regard to job loss?
Great question, by the way.
I think that all technology eventually leads to job loss of one sector. Like, so for example, weavers in the 1800s, when machines came in, there was mass job losses amongst the weaving community, mass famines, people just could not make ends meet. The more, every time you introduce new technology, you will encounter job losses, and I do think AI is the same. But I also think that when new technologies come in, new industries are formed as well. So I do think that what's more important to maybe think about is not just job loss, it's also protecting a population to be able to then help retrain so that it can then be deployed to do other things. So our job loss is possible. With all the experimentation I've done in the last 2-3 years, we're a little far away from that right now. Apart from, I guess, the forklift drivers, at least in the industries that I've been in, they will come for sure. But then there's also hopefully time for us to be able to redeploy, people into adjacent industries that basically come through as well.
So how about outside of job loss? Do any of you think there's any other unintended negative consequences of AI? And if so, what?
Conscious this is the last question, do we really want to end on such a...
think of what it's going to do to the legal profession, where you have all these young lawyers who write briefs and do this and this. Like the stories I hear, that's going to be dramatically reduced through the implementation of AI. So now those are smart young people. They'll go off and do something else, right? Mm-hmm. So, that's what you said. It's important to understand that a board and management will attempt to, first thing they'll do is they'll attempt to use AI to reduce costs.
Yep.
That's the first thing they will do, right? The other benefits will come over time. That's what I think.
Agreed. So there will be an impact, no doubt. I don't think we know what it is yet. So, this question does come up quite a bit, and I think the answer is, nobody really knows what the impact is yet. The metaphor of the Industrial Revolution has been thrown out a lot, but I do think it's a good metaphor. It's that, when the Industrial Revolution came, and actually with every time we've had a major technological change, there's been a disruption of jobs. Mm-hmm. But what happens is new jobs get created. And if you think about all the jobs that didn't exist before the Industrial Revolution, we absolutely couldn't even be thought of before the, and then now. So I think that's what's going to happen. There will be displacement, but there'll also be creation. So, and we don't know what the gap might be, if there is a gap.
but you've seen it happen in history quite a few times. I do think that will happen with AI as well.
Now, I know we're out of time, so I'm going to ask everyone a quick fire question so it ends on a positive note. and we don't need the why, we just need the name of it. I want you to tell me your favorite podcast.
Podcast? Yes. Ooh, Pivot.
I like that a political podcast. I'm not going to give a name because it would distinguish who I am, but I like political podcasts.
Carol?
I think it's called Rethinking. It's Adam Grant's.
Okay, perfect.
In all honesty, I'm too busy to listen to podcasts.
I really recommend on Eye on AI. It's very eye-opening on AI transition and AI adoption in different verticals and places.
Perfect. And favorite book?
Oh, God. Sort of skip me.
Joy Bullen-Winnie's book, which is all around AI bias, is actually fantastic. I recommend that 100%.
A book I just recently read that I really, really enjoyed, Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow. If you haven't read it, it's really fun. It's a good book.
I just read the most recent Grisham book. That was great. I like those Grisham books.
I recently read Presence by Amy Cuddy, and I think it's a really great... We're talking about skills. That would be a great one to read for upskilling.
And I recently read Think Big by Dr. Grace Lorton, who's going to be closing the session for us. So over to you, Grace.
I'm just going to use this moment for another shameless plug as well. We have a podcast in the Vision Initiative called Workforce, Teresa Almeida, who's sitting in the front row, and we address that question about job loss. So if anyone who's interested in that, please do listen to the episode. We had Nobel laureate Christopher Pissarides talking about it. Slightly less optimistic, I think, than the comments on the panel, but nonetheless optimistic about the future. For me, I just want to take a moment to thank the great panel. I wrote down some of the highlights for me in the discussion, and it's interesting for you to reflect on what your highlights are. I loved Noah's optimism that ethics is actually needed to stay profitable in this sector. Again, I'm a bit more pessimistic on that. Something I was really optimistic about was Reshma's message about emails, and that actually emailing increases my environmental footprint. So now I'm going to reduce my amount of emailing. And also the CEO WhatsApp group. So anyone who's reading the media recently, I think what they're talking about is getting everyone back into the office 5 days a week in that same group. Matt, I think it was interesting to hear that more than 50% of people aren't using AI, and also that there's a race to the bottom from the regulation perspective, which I agree with. Why would you opt into regulation if it's not necessarily imposed. Richard, I loved your comments on regulation as well, and I also do disagree with you that profs know less than their students in artificial intelligence. I think I know more because I embrace Carlin's philosophy that we should be experimenting for 10 hours a day and getting to know the artificial intelligence technology. And on that, I have to say, I've never made a lot of money on the stock market, but I did make some money betting on Ocado shares because I followed their technology and noticed, just like Richard, that they were actually replacing their workers with technology about 10 years ago now. So if anybody is worried about job loss, can I encourage you to start paying attention to the investments companies are making, not just on paper, because people do have a lot of guff around artificial intelligence, which is an Irish word for beating up what they're actually doing. But just go and look. Go and look at the factories, how it's being employed, see the technology, feel the technology, ask yourself if it's actually useful. And on that, I'm going to let you go. It's 8 o'clock. Our next event is on generations working together in the workforce, and it's going to be over in the Shard. And we have a bigger budget, so we're inviting you to a networking reception. So should you be interested, please do come along. All that's left for me to do is to thank you, the audience, thank the online audience, thank Debbie for manning the questions, and also to thank Belton for moderating, Noah, Matt, Carlin, Richard.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.